welcome to the latest episode of the I Need to Effing Talk to You podcast. If you are a leader who is serious about building your leadership skills and transforming your organizational culture, you are in the right place. I'm Russell Stratton.
And I'm Ken Cameron. And in this episode, we need to effing talk to you about separating the person from the behavior. Because it's really dangerous to equate the person with the behavior. We're going to get into and talk about that. Because it's not helpful to think of our employees as effing unmanageable, flawed individuals for whom there's new hope. So we need to develop a new language to talk about these employees with. So Russell, that's going to be our topic today.
Absolutely. And as you hinted at, Ken, this has been a theme of our work for some time. And the important thing that we emphasize to our clients on our workshops is this desire about separating behavior from person. I think one of the things that we found there is, as you said, if you say that somebody is, you know, an unmanageable employee, and you may listeners may remember an earlier episode when we focused on that specific topic, then we're really leaving no hope for us to work with that person to improve their performance or improve their behavior to get them to an acceptable level. Whereas if we can identify that this is an element of their behavior currently that is either not up to standard or is not helpful or is causing problems in the organization, then we can deal with that behavior because we still accept that the person is worth saving, I suppose, is the easiest way to look at it.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. In my earlier career in the world of theater, I encountered this in a couple of different ways. But the way it really crystallized for me is a story that I often tell in our workshops, and it's even included in our book. And for any listeners that have heard me say this story before, please scroll through and fast forward through the next like 3 minutes while I tell the story again. It's the story about one of my mentors, Peter Hinton, who was the artistic director of English theater at the National Arts Center in Ottawa. He's one of Canada's great directors. And he taught me not to believe in talent. He said that he doesn't believe in talent because as soon as you decide that this one person is more talented than this other person, say an actor has more talent than another actor, then it suggests that the person who has less talent isn't worth dealing with. In fact, it kind of calls into question, why did you hire this person at all if they don't have talent? So instead, he suggests looking at the fact that everyone is talented, but that some individuals are either experiencing some sort of obstacle that's preventing them from bringing their best selves to the table on this particular occasion. So his job as a theater director is to unlock that obstacle or unlock that potential within his quote unquote employees so that they can be the best collaborators they can be. And he finds that conversely, when he works with people who think of this person has talent and this person doesn't have talent, then you can see that person being written off.
That's an excellent, I always love that story, Ken. I think it's an excellent point because it's this piece about potential is what sticks with me. Because you're saying everybody has potential to different degrees. Our job as a leader is to identify that potential, nurture it, and bring it to the fore. If we're simply going to say, as you mentioned in your story, that, okay, so these are the talented people in my team and these are the not talented people, we're already describing them as that's them as a person and that writing off piece, and we're not accepting about that potential. And I think that that's doing us a disservice as a leader. It's doing them a disservice as an employee, and it's doing our organization a disservice. You know, if you look in the sports arena, for example, you know, you often find that some of the greatest coaches are the people that were able to take people who had potential and raise them up to deliver more than anyone expected. You know, the great English soccer coach, Brian Clough, was renowned for the fact that he was able to take players who other people had written off and suddenly put them into a team that ended up being a championship winner, winning multiple European Cups, would not have happened if he'd surely gone, okay, who are the most talented people that are available on the transfer market? Let me just go in and buy them. So, you know, that was always thought was an example of somebody who delivered on potential of what people could do with his colleague, Peter Taylor. I have to mention, it wasn't just Clough. He's sort of co-coach, Peter Taylor, identifying potential and then being able to get people to deliver more than they necessarily thought they could do.
And what's truly inspiring in the world of sports is when you have a team that succeeds and goes all the way to the finals and doesn't have one of those anchor stars, but instead is an entire ensemble or real true team in of people who would otherwise have been unknowns had they not come together and been coached to reach their fullest potential as a group.
Absolutely. And again, in that sort of, you know, team competition, there have been as many tales of teams that have come together without perhaps that superstar, as well as you've had teams full of superstars who just don't gel as a team because they're working as a group of individuals, but not as a team. And I think some of that can feed off from our idea of what we can potentially do with our group, necessarily that we're only looking for established talent that we're gonna put forward. And you no doubt see this in the arts world as well.
I do. And you know, sometimes you see that happen where it's you can take a team of all-stars, and having too many all-stars can be a problem. I mean, we saw this in the Miami Heat when they had three major all-stars on their team, and yet somehow they still failed to win the championship that year. And yet it was only subsequently when they brought in Shane Battier onto that team that that person became the leader who brought out the best in everybody else. And Shane Battier was cited by one sports writer as a no-stats all-star. His statistics were not particularly impressive on his own. But when you looked at the stats, whenever he was on the court, everybody else played better. When Shane Battier was on the court, it often meant that the team scored as many as 13 points more in that particular game. And in the NBA, when games are won or lost by a margin of 10 points, 13 points can mean the difference between victory and not. And so I think it's really interesting to look at how even a member of the team can be a leader from within.
Absolutely. And we talk again about this on our workshops often, that, you know, leadership is not just a position. It's not just a title that you have. It's something that comes from within, and people can lead at different levels of an organization. And just you mentioning that point around, you know, bringing the best out of others. It remembers me when I used to play what would be beer league soccer. And I claim nothing. I was a garbage player. You know, I think I was the guy. I organized the team. I think that's how I got to play in it. But we had a guy who played with us for a couple of seasons who had played for a brief time professionally. Now, he'd since retired. He was in his sort of at that time, probably early late 30s, early 40s. But I remember asking him in the bar after one game, you know, why do you think this, you're not the star of the team? And he said, well, no, I don't see my role as being the star of the team, even though he could say he was a better player technically than anybody else. He said, I see my role is to make the rest of you look good. And that's what he did. He would make it that he could. What he would do was the way to bring people into the game that made them look better than perhaps they actually were. It wasn't about all about him. And it was a very interesting lesson for me from a leadership perspective, a line there, that being a leader or having somebody that perhaps has a degree of ability or talent isn't about you. It's about what you do to bring everybody else up. Not you sitting yourself on a pedestal. But I'm conscious that we slightly digress off of our topic, but I think they're interesting points that we've, for our listeners there, just to consider.
I think that's our general structure is, you know, starting with a point and then digressing. And then at about the halfway point of the podcast, realizing we've digressed and drawing us back to the point, which in this case is separating the person from the behavior. And one of the things that we often do as leaders is that we think that where the other person is at is wrong, and we end up trying to bring them to where we're at. And Russell, you've got a great analogy for this that I often admire so much that I can't repeat it. So I'm just going to ask you to give it.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, well, I always said it's like being on a sort of pathway with someone. You're standing at one end and they're standing at the other end. And I think the analogy that you use is it's like, well, I believe I'm in the right place. I'm in the place where you need to be. So I'm just going to shout at you, come and join me. And I can use whatever, you know, motivational mechanisms to persuade you that you need to come to be where I am. And then be surprised when you don't come to where I am and aren't in the same place as me. So either mentally or physically. And what I see the analogy is that perhaps we need to actually walk towards somebody, still beckoning them towards us, but encouraging them to come and join us, so that in some way we're starting to go to meet people as where they are and then lead them to where we need them to be. rather than just stand there shouting at them, saying how stupid you are that you don't realize that you need to be over here. It's not really helpful. And I think that's, again, about seeing where somebody is, treating them as an individual and focusing on, okay, I need to bring you over here. You're not a bad person because you're standing where you are. And I've found that a useful analogy to use over the years in my work.
And that analogy kind of opens up two other analogies for me as well. And one is that once you reach where the other person is at on the path, you can see the world from their perspective. Perhaps you see that, well, actually, maybe they're standing at a fork in the road and where they're headed is actually not such a bad place after all. Maybe it'll get you to the same destination, you know, the low road versus the high road. And so maybe the path of least resistance, to stretch the metaphor to the point of absurdity, is actually the road that they're on. So you might learn something by coming to meet them where they're at and looking at the world from their perspective. Conversely, you might find that's not the right path, but you can see that from their perspective, it looks like the path that you're suggesting is too difficult a path. It looks like it's overgrown with weeds, or it looks like it's too rocky or too steep. But then you can point out to them, no, it's okay. I've been over there and it's not as bad as it looks. And in fact, it's easier once you get over that hump. It's all downhill from there, so to speak. So you can see once you reach where that, once you start to look at the world from their perspective, what might be preventing them from joining you on the preferred path.
Oh, this is true, Ken. And I think another piece to that is that when you meet somebody where they are, you understand things from their perspective. And sometimes you can find if you hold opinions strongly, you know, you're vehement in your belief in something, then somebody who holds in a different view to you, but they may also be as vehement in their belief. And if we don't try and understand where they're coming from, why they believe things and why they think the way that they do and why they think their way is the best way, then we risk in the danger that we always end up in this sort of adversarial situation about a wrong and right. I'm right, that means you must obviously be wrong then because I'm right. You know, and in fact, the fact that both people will believe that, but they, you know, we flip that, they believe that they're right and they believe that I'm wrong. So we get nowhere if we see in that sort of, the detente between each other. Whereas if we can actually go and meet where they are, understand their perspective on why they're doing what they're doing, then we can start to work with them to move in a direction, as you say, that could be closer to us or could be a combination of the two options, but somewhere where it ultimately is going to be more productive for everyone.
Russell, I found that I was at fault of making this mistake of confusing the behavior with a person early in my career. I had just graduated from university. I had started my first theater collective, and I found that some members of the group were not as committed as other members of the group. So I was kind of leading this collective, and I found that I was shouldering a lot of the work, myself and maybe one or two other people, and then other individuals were kind of just phoning it in or showing up only just for the bits that they were involved in and not stepping forward and really leading the group, which kind of says two things. One, it says something about my leadership style, that I was kind of leading and pushing this collective, which suggests, why is it a collective if it's got one leader? So it suggests that there was kind of a framing or organizational structure that was flawed to begin with. But I also, as a leader, made the mistake of perceiving the others as what you and I would term individuals who were wearing their sun hat. So individuals who would rather be on the beach reading a book rather than actually engaged in doing the work. And I'm not sure that when I look back on it, that my perception was correct. When I look back with the benefit of 20/20/20 hindsight, so that's looking 20/20 past 20 years, I realize that some of these individuals were less engaged, partly because they didn't sign up for that. They signed up to be an actor in the ensemble. They didn't sign up to be stuffing envelopes, to be finding sponsorships, to be putting up posters, to be designing the set, to be building the costumes. They just wanted to show up to do the bit that they were engaged by. And I made the mistake of deciding for them that they should be engaged in the whole in the same way that I was. And I only learned this by watching other people making the same mistakes when I was an outsider. And then I could reflect back and say, oh, that's what I was doing.
Well, that's interesting when you say that, Ken, because that concept of, you know, standing back and watching others in a similar situation and observing what they're doing reminds me of an exercise with neuro-linguistic programming called perceptual positions, which is we use a variation of this in our workshops. Which is, in our workshops, we will run through a scenario with a group. We will have our actor playing a particular character, in many cases a difficult employee or a difficult customer or a difficult co-worker. And then we will have our participant being themselves as a manager or team member, whatever the context is. And they play that out in real time, you know, with the two of them. But we also enable sometimes to rerun the scenario, having somebody else work with the actor. And I think that gives an example of what you were talking about. People then get the chance to sit back, watch the same scenario with the same parameters, but they're watching somebody else deal with it. Two things come from that. If the person deals with it in a similar way to them, they can sometimes see what some of the pitfalls could be, but also they get the opportunity to see somebody perhaps deal with the same circumstances in a different way, which sometimes that light bulb comes on for someone when they go, ah, yeah, okay, now I see why this is a problem, and perhaps I could try X in the future, and that may be the key that unlocks the lock and we make progress.
It's great that we can talk about this in the work context, but this notion of separating the behavior from the person is also useful in kind of a more societal context, right? Like we see it in the larger world at large, particularly it strikes me in the world of politics where things are so polarized, right? And if somebody holds a different view from me, either a different political view or a different view on an issue of the day, or like what's going on right now in the pandemic is this polarization between people who are vaccinated and people who refuse to get vaccinated. And one side views the other as, you know, either callous or unscientific. And then one side might view the other as kind of sheep who are just being herded by government pressure. So and both sides view the others as either callous or fools or dangerous to society in some ways. So I think that if we could bring the same attitude of separate the behavior from the person, we could realize these are not necessarily bad people. They hold a different belief than me. They're exhibiting different behavior than I am.
Well, I agree. And just in your description there, one of the things I was thinking about, you say, you know, people who are vaccinated and the people who aren't going to get vaccinated. And you say, well, people who aren't going to get vaccinated yet. Doesn't mean they may not, you know, the idea that everybody who isn't is unvaccinated is necessarily never going to get vaccinated and is refusing to do it. And when we start to get a little bit of understanding and meet that, why is it that you're not vaccinated? Sometimes people have got quite legitimate concerns or quite legitimate reasons why they haven't taken that step to be vaccinated. They're not just, what I see somebody post on social media, I think amplifies this, but somebody was talking about not being vaccinated. Oh, so you want children to die then? And it's like, it's taking that step from you have a position I don't agree with to you are like, you're an evil person. You're a child killer because you won't do what I think you should do. And of course, you know, you can see that person comes back with their view and how they're going to, you know, what they're going to do about the situation or whatever. So I think you're absolutely right. The danger that we seem to be in an ever polarized position politically, I think the pandemic hasn't helped with that because we've all been in our little pods, in our little bubbles, in conversing with people that are like us and not had a chance to get out there and actually meet people face-to-face who are different to us, who view things different to us, and have a conversation. But it's also this piece that we think, because somebody has a different opinion to us, therefore it's not just they've got a different opinion on X, but they're somehow a bad person. They're a deplorable. They're evil. You know, and I before we were on their podcast, I said, you know, you and I have traveled around parts of Canada over the last few years for work. We've done many journeys in Alberta up and down that Queen Elizabeth Highway up and down to Edmonton and had many conversations. We've had many meals and conversations about a variety of subjects. Sometimes there's things, shock horror to our listeners, that Ken and I don't agree on. We have different views. But I've always found coming out of that conversation that I've learned more about what you think. It's given me a different perspective on something. Has it changed my view? Not necessarily. Sometimes it has, sometimes it hasn't. But guess what? We're still friends and colleagues. We, you know, we don't not speak to each other and go, oh, I can't have this. Oh, God, whatever. Ken has a different view to me. So I think, you know, because we're trying to separate the opinions or behaviors from us as people, I think helps. And that obviously in saying that, I'm not suggesting that, that Ken and I, of course, are these great beings above everybody else and therefore yeah, better than everyone else because we've been able to do that. But I think it's just saying, look, if we can do this, then I think we can, everybody collectively can take a moment just to pause and say, are we disagreeing with the behavior or a particular opinion? Not that this person is an evil person that we must never speak to again.
No, it's true. If flawed individuals such as Russell and I, people who are so antagonistic generally, who get triggered so easily and hold such strong opinions, can learn to get along, so can anybody else. But you alluded earlier, Russell, about how social media kind of amplifies this distance between people. And yet at the same time, it's not new, right? This demonizing of the other side has gone on for centuries. Like, I mean, even if you go back as far back as like, you know, the early 1900s with the in the homeland of your home country, where the Irish Troubles really divided the along sectarian lines in Ireland, from the beginning, that really polarized along those religious divide, and really, it really was about demonizing the other side.
Absolutely, and I mean that went on for many years, and still to today. I mean, it's thankfully things are not as bad today as they were, but certainly in through to the up to the 1990s in the Peace Accord, where you could have two groups of people who would be literally separated by a street. And the people over here would never cross the road to see the people over there. They would never speak. You don't talk to them. They're different to us. You know, they're evil. We have nothing to do with each other. And a wonderful story from that, which I think illustrates the point of separating a person from their opinion, was the story of Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness. So briefly, Ian Paisley was the unionist leader, Protestant, very much about the Ireland staying in the United Kingdom. Martin McGuinness was a leader with Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army, very much about a united Ireland and the Catholic part of Ireland separating from the rest of the United Kingdom. So you had a Catholic and a Protestant, one wanting to stay as part of Great Britain, one wanting to separate from Great Britain. Basically, everything that they would ever talk about politically would be the different sides, you know, and this was a violent conflict at some points. You know, people were killing each other over this. This wasn't just people sending mean tweets to each other. This was, you know, some pretty heavy duty stuff that we saw for a number of years. The point, just to give an illustration of how much people felt about this, if you remember the Ian Paisley in the European Parliament when the Pope visited, got up and was called the Pope the Antichrist before he was led out of the chamber. He felt that strongly as being anti-Catholic feeling. So you can imagine these two guys, in no universe are they even going to be in the same room together. We get into the 90s, we have the Peace Accord. Part of that was you need to power share, and Martin McGuinness, Ian Paisley find themselves being forced together to work together in government. And what do we think happened? They disagreed over policy issues. They disagreed on many, you know, ways forward. They worked a loose agreement to get things done. But something else I found was more remarkable. They actually found that they liked each other personally. They shared the same sense of humor and found that they built over the years a friendship between each other personally, even though they had held diametrically opposed views and still had views that were opposed to each other politically, but their commonality, their, I suppose, shared humanity of what was similar between them, that they actually enjoyed each other's company. And I think that's always been a sort of a slight inspiration for me to think about the way forward, even when this polarizing times that we find ourselves in at the moment, that even if the people who could be the biggest opponents of each other on opinion wise can still be friends, then that gives hope to all of us that, you know, we don't have to agree with everybody all the time, but it doesn't mean we can't get on with people and be friendly with them and cordial in our interactions.
That's a great story to wrap up with, Russell. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, there's a quote that we can insert here from the American writer Brené Brown that speaks to what you've just described and to our overall theme here. And the quote that really sticks with me is this: people are hard to hate close up, so move in. And that's kind of what we see in your story about Ian Paisley and... No, wait, sorry. Is it Brian Paisley and Ian McGuinness, or is it Ian Paisley and Brian McGuinness?
Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, yeah.
So we see Brené Brown's quote reflected in those two. And we see it reflected in a lot of the stories we've told today around bringing this new attitude to your workplace about not demonizing the other person, but separating the behavior from the person. So with that, this wraps up our episode. We hope that you enjoyed it. Remember to subscribe via Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Share the link with your friends, colleagues, and always reach out to us at the email or in the show notes. So goodbye for now, and we'll effing talk to you soon.
Goodbye.